It is super fun to be here today with Harish Niyothotu again. We've had several conversations and they're always fascinating. And Harish is working on some projects that are still in progress. So he might be able to give us a little bit of an update on that. But also, there are a few things that we wanted to talk about in the whole area of risk and how that connects to the unknown. So I thought that would be fun to talk about too. But Harish, why don't you tell us where you're at right at the moment in terms of what you're up to and what your plans are, and then maybe we can look at a couple of video clips and discuss those.
Great. It's always a pleasure to be back here at the Minicode and to see you too, Karen. So, what I was able to do during the past, let's say, 4 or 5 months, was to actually pursue this hunch that I had that anyone that wishes, let's say, to develop their own theory. Maybe it's not a full-fledged theory of everything, but it is still a scientific theory that explains some real phenomena. They also need to have a cognitive and philosophical even framework that complements, let's say, that whole effort. So I had this hunch that at least in my case, one of the most significant aspects that I need to dive deep into is something called, basically, it's a very specific branch of philosophy called the philosophy of mathematics, that, of course, has to do a lot with what I am currently pursuing, because I started my journey, as you know, from the from number theory and prime numbers. So it was really significant, let's say, this type of pursuit into the philosophy of mathematics. And one of the good things that I was able to extract, let's say, out of it was one very specific type of what I call a meta hypothesis. Basically, in the context of creating and generating hypotheses that they could be falsified or verified, let's say, via experiments or computational, let's say, paradigms. This sort of meta hypothesis actually is what guides my own hypothesis generation process. So you can imagine it in the following way. There is this overarching meta hypothesis, as I call it, and it allows me to generate different instantiations that, in simple terms, there are other hypotheses, let's say, across different domains, but maybe in my case, they are still part of philosophy of mathematics. So I was able to pursue that particular route. I really got into I followed my hunch, let's say, and I really believe that there is some knowledge, let's say, or something good that can be extracted out of the Platonic dialogues. So I really dive deep into some of the works of Plato, like the Republic, the Timaeus and Dialogue, and more and more in that particular, let's say, domain of literature. And I was able to put my this idea, let's say, into practice. So I was able to create three different hypotheses. And one of them had to do with the Timaeus dialogue and the so-called creation of the world soul, which is a beautiful passage from the Timaeus Platonic dialogue, where Plato recounts the way that the the creator created the world. So it's a very cryptic, let's say, text. But because I have this notion that at the very deepest layer, the universe, let's say, it's mathematical, and it is comprised from these fundamental building blocks that they are the prime numbers, I was able to test that hypothesis of mine and even present it to an audience, and I got very good results. And now one of the things that I am doing is I am also working on that particular front. So that's one of the three things.
That's very exciting. Well, when you talk about the meta hypothesis and the overarching idea, the overarching philosophy, I don't know if you had a chance to watch the episode that I did with Cory Barker on his new book on arch disciplinarity.
I watch a bit, a small part.
Yeah. Well, what we covered in that hour and a half is only a tiny slice of what's in the book, but he and his co-author, who I believe, if I'm not wrong, is Brendan Graham Dempsey of the meta-modernity concept. Their idea is that above all the meta-hypotheses, there is another level that is what they call arch disciplinarity. So it's an overarching that allows all these meta hypotheses to be generated, and then within the meta hypotheses there's all the hypotheses generated, so it's a hierarchy of ideas. And I think it's a very interesting concept. And I mean, you know, my whole gig is that I tend to think of it as underneath rather than above. But I think that what is encompassing all of these things is a set of principles. So, which I'm not going to get into here. But anyway, so that thing about the arch hypothesis. And then you mentioned Plato. And so I was listening this morning to a conversation with Dr. Michael Levin and Gunnar Babcock. And who was the other guy? Daniel McShay. And apparently Gunnar Babcock is a philosopher, maybe a philosopher of science or of mathematics. I wasn't quite sure. And Daniel McShay works in ecology. Now, in the Daniel McShay conversation, well, in the whole conversation with these three guys, you know, Michael Levin is all about the cognitive, he talks about the cognitive glue that's connecting the cells together.
Yeah.
He believes that cognition goes all the way down to the cell level and potentially even further down. And he bases his ideas on Platonic theory, particularly the mathematical, that the numbers exist independent of everything else. And he won't go so far as to talk about the creator and the creation of the world, but nevertheless, he does talk about these Platonic ideas. And so they're having this conversation, and Daniel McShay brings up the Mount St. Helens disaster. I don't know if you're familiar with that. There was a huge volcano on the west coast of the U.S., believe it was in Washington State, Mount St. Helens. And it was 1989, maybe, that Mount St. Helens erupted. There were actually people doing studies on the mountain that were killed when that it erupted. And it just blew the top off the mountain. It was a huge, it affected even the weather for many months afterwards. But what resulted then is all the lava comes down and completely eradicates all life and builds up this new rocky surface.
Yeah.
And yet here we are only 30 years afterwards, and the ecology has regenerated on Mount St. Helens. And this guy says this is the greatest mystery because there's no life there at all. It's just rock. And he's contemplating that the plants themselves, either the plants themselves have some sort of knowledge of how to regenerate the same ecosystem that was there before, or there's some sort of top-down causation. And so they're contemplating this idea. So I'm just going to play this little clip from the video. It's very, very interesting.
Awesome.
I got to share my screen, I guess. I'm very slow at this, so I apologize to everybody. You can see Michael Levin and Gunnar Babcock and Daniel Mache.
Yes.
Okay. Let's get this started.
So then there's the perspective question with the Mount St. Helens thing. If you take the perspective of the ecosystem, which doesn't exist yet, right after the volcano has gone off, but you look at it as a pack of nutrients, and here I'm going to go weird on you and take the thermodynamic view, pack of nutrients that's sitting there at high potential, wanting to be dissipated to space, asking itself, what am I going to do now? Mm-hmm. The answer is, I'm going to get a high growth rate nutrient nature of the nutrient independent plant to grow in me. And I don't know what plant it's going to be. I don't really care. I just know in these awful situations where there ain't nothing, and I'm just going to sit here forever, not dissipating to space my latent heat at all. I need something like that to come along. And as soon as it does, I'm going to give it whatever it needs to set the process in motion. This is spooky shit.
Yeah.
But you're nodding, and that sort of scares me.
So they get scared by this stuff because they don't know what to do with this idea that there is something beyond just the material world.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You know, one of my favorite quotes from Plato is that man is a being in search of meaning. So
could you say it again?
Yes, man is a being in search of meaning.
Oh, like Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that would be the same as these rocks on Mount St. Helens are in search of, the rocks of Mount St. Helens are somehow in search of plants that will come and take their nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that will reconstitute the ecosystem. And I can see why he says it's spooky. It is very peculiar, right?
Yeah. Two things. One has to do with this, what Einstein called spooky action at a distance, mm-hmm. when he was referring to the quantum entanglement, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That actually... it is a real phenomenon, so you know, but he was spooked about it. So if we take it, let's say, at this ecological level, yes, it is a good way to describe it, let's say. And another thing is this notion from Dr. Ian McGilchrist,
mm-hmm.
this notion of fittedness, that I am also deeply looking into. And it seems that different types, let's say, of, for lack of a better word, entities, let's say, somehow they fit together. And out of that fittedness, something else arises. So.
Well, I don't know how many of my episodes that you've watched where we talk about measurement.
Mm-hmm.
We talk quite a bit about measurement and just all of the mysterious aspects of measurement and how impossible it is to make measurement completely precise. And yet measurement is necessary. And this fittedness, well, I've been doing some word studies in the scripture and looking at like judgment and justice and measurement. And those are kind of all stemming from the same place. So you can think about, if you think about, I don't know how to put this into words without falling into heresy, but
yeah.
But if you think about the the universe as if you think that a perfect universe is possible. We are not in a perfect universe. We're in a universe that's marred by failure and sin and struggle and all of that. But if you think that there is a perfect universe possible, that perfect universe is perfectly measured, perfectly precise. Everything is perfectly fitted the way that it's supposed to be fitted. And it seems to me that love is somehow drawing everything in the universe, everything in the cosmos towards this perfection. So it's drawing everything towards this fittedness to align with the fittedness of the perfect, of the perfection that is possible. And so that's all I have to say.
No, that's beautiful. And I fully agree with that. Trying to tie it a bit back with the notion of the Platonic forms, let's say. But also, this is something that also resonates with my own theory, let's say, the mathematical theory. I think that when we start to contemplate, let's say, the imperfect variants of a structure, let's call it like that, it is only then that we can start imagining these perfect structures that exist in this abstract realm, let's say, that Plato is calling the forms. And I don't know, I can also see this like in terms of my own belief, like in Christianity, and like in heaven everything is perfect, right? So and in a way such a place exists outside of both time and space. So it's something that Wolfgang Smith called the Ave Eternal, if I am I'm not mistaken. It's the eternal realm, let's say, that is never ending. It's without a beginning and without an end.
Mm-hmm. So, So getting back to the prime numbers here, one of the things that Michael Levin mentioned in that video, and I don't have the clip, but he was talking, I think he was saying that when they talk about like cicadas, which is a certain kind of a cricket thing, that they come back like every 13 years or every 17 years or 13 Cycle. Days and 17 days, or some cyclical thing. And he said, you know, when you ask the scientists why that is, they'll say, oh, well, those are prime numbers. As though that answers the question. But why would they think that that answers the question?
Yeah.
If they're not Platonists, why would they think that that answers the question?
Basically, to try to answer that, I think they are the only, out of the three types of reasoning, induction, deduction, and abduction, the only one that is left for anyone that tries to contemplate once again in such type of questions is neither induction nor abstraction, not deduction. It's only abduction. It's inference to the most plausible, let's say, answer. So I think this is what they are trying to optimal in grip, to use a nice term from John Verveke.
Well, but I mean, it's very mysterious why prime numbers would be the answer. I mean, why that's the most plausible explanation, that's very mysterious.
Yeah, I think there is something deep there. And maybe it also has to do with the to put it, these cycles, the way they repeat, let's say, it makes them especially unique that they repeat that their period, let's say, or periodicity resonates with a prime number. If it was any other case, then maybe the environment, let's say, within our planet will never have changed and during the different epochs. But because we have this, it's not something that it repeats again. And this is one of my, let's say, the things that I am not fully agreeing with Sarah Penrose, and because he has this conception of the cyclic universe, that there were many universes, let's say, and each when one ends, the next one begins. So it's this cyclic notion of universes, and I don't believe that's the case.
Yeah, really it's very convenient, though. It's a convenient answer. Yeah,
yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. So, just to make a small, let's say, comment that has to do with this notion of the meta hypothesis, where you have, let's say, a meta hypothesis that allows you to generate meta hypotheses, that each of those allows you to generate hypotheses. So in a way, the one that I am offering here, it is one that has to do with this domain of philosophy of mathematics. So of course, other such meta hypotheses exist. So that's a beautiful notion, let's say, and way to frame things. If you want, I can go through it, and we can discuss it a bit. It's okay with you?
Yes, absolutely. The philosophy of mathematics.
Yeah. So yes. My meta hypothesis has to do with, as I mentioned earlier, with hypothesis generation, and it goes like this: hypothesis emerges from choice and knowledge. We refine it with insight until it becomes self-evident. So there are four main keywords here. One is choice, like the individual agent, let's say cognitive agent, makes a choice. As in my case, it was my choice to focus on that particular domain of mathematics, let's say. Additionally, it has to do with knowledge. So we already, someone that already studies something, it is like a prerequisite to be able to generate a hypothesis about that domain. If someone is like a newbie into a field, then even if they generate a hypothesis, in most likely probability, let's say, that would be not a good one. But someone that studies, let's say, for a very long period of time or very hard, then they are able to, let's say, engage in this hypothesis generation and offer it to the scientists for them to falsify or verify. And the third term, it's insight, because what I'm saying is that we start from an initial version of the hypothesis, and then utilize our insights that we gain by experimenting, let's say, and then that results in the refinement of the hypothesis. So there is also this type of process that is inherent in what I call hypothesis generation. And the last one is that it becomes self-evident. And that, for me, it's the strongest, let's say, aspect of it, that because, you know, we live in during an era where you say something is self-evident, you will get a lot of negative feedback, let's say, or maybe you get also some positive as well, but it's not something that modern scientists, let's say, accept it like that. But I really believe that that boils down into the following. Eternal truths exist.
Yes, 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 yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, I totally get it. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
So this is one of the reasons that I follow Michael Levin so closely, because he has through his own choice and knowledge chosen this arena of cells and looking at cells and figuring out how they're communicating with each other and how they do the things that they do and what that communication consists of and how it could be experimentally verified or researched further. Mm-hmm. And then he has, he's refining it through insight, but not only his own insight. He's talking to people in every domain that he can find, people who are, I don't know if you watched, in one of my recent episodes, I talked about how at the conference, I met this lady who said that when she was younger, she used to go to parties and she'd always ask this question, what is it that you have studied or that you have learned where you've discovered there's no, that you've learned it so well, you've discovered there's no bottom.
Yeah.
And so what Michael Levin is doing is he's talking to people who have focused in on a niche and they have studied to the point where they know it so well that they know somehow that connects to everything else in the world. And he's talking to those people and he's getting their viewpoint about their arena and seeing what he can learn from that in his little arena of cells. And so what that does is just opens up this vast kind of landscape of opportunity of ideas. And so I love listening to him when he's having these conversations with people.
Yeah.
And this idea that something becomes self-evident, it's like that truth is waiting there to be found.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the privilege of searching for it.
Yes.
And we do that through our own choice and our choice leads us to develop the knowledge that we need in order to, you know, be able to have the insights that then can make this thing become self-evident. Yeah, that's a beautiful theory. I really like it. I like
yeah.
it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I was listening recently to Edward Frankel.
Yes, I like him.
Yeah, I like him too. I like him too. And he was discussing, I think it was with Kurt from TOE.
Yes,
and, uh-huh. and he was discussing this question that keeps popping up. People even ask me, like even some of my professors, let's say, they ask me, like, are mathematics created or invented?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if you ask a mathematician, especially a pure mathematician, what they will answer, at least most of them, let's say, it will be they are discovered. Like this realm already exists,
mm-hmm.
and somehow we were guided, or we were lucky enough to stumble upon it. So it as I said it is like, if it wasn't discovered by me, then it will be discovered by someone else. So mm-hmm. you know. And Edward Frankel was pondering upon that question once more. And he was saying that I used to always answer for many years, mathematics get discovered. But recently I started reevaluating that a bit. And now I'm thinking that maybe both things are happening. And I was thinking of that, and I was saying to myself, okay, I need to really think about this. why he arrived at this conclusion now. And the reason, as far as I understand it, is because he's heavily engaged with this Langlands program that has to do with the consilience, let's say, and this effort to unify different domains within mathematics and finding parallels, let's say, between them. And I realized the following. You know what the current, let's say, pushback in terms of string theory is that it is not verifiable. You cannot falsify it, you cannot verify it. And the interesting thing is that string theory, it's the main theory, let's say, in physics that for many decades, that actually got created by mathematical physicists. So if it was up to the physicists, they would have never gotten into the string theory, let's say. And the interesting thing is the following. To a mathematician, especially to a pure mathematician, it doesn't, they create something, let's say they discover something, and they are not concerned with any practical application, let's say, of that particular thing. But the physicists, they always say, but you need to make experiments in order to validate that or to falsify it. So if something does not go, let's say, with the so-called Karl Popper's notion of falsifiability, then it's not useful in the realm of physics. And this is why the physicists, they keep pushing against string theory after many, many decades, because it didn't, no results came out of it, let's say. This is an oversimplification, because if you, once again, if you shift the focus back to the mathematical side, the mathematicians will tell you, but no, we've created these beautiful mathematical structures in many, many dimensions. And of course, it's very useful because it allows us to visualize something very out there. And the physicist once again comes and say, but we're living in a 4D, 3D, let's say, world. So all these hidden dimensions do not have any practical applicability. So it's like a fun exercise for the mathematicians. It doesn't have any additional, let's say, value. And going back to this question that Edward Fraenkel was revisiting, let's say, I think this is the reason that he's trying to take the middle ground in order to not completely, let's say, push under the bus the mathematical physicists. Like, there is value there only if, even only it has to do with the aesthetics of mathematics, let's say. So that's how
Let me just clarify. So are you saying then that the mathematical physicists that have come up with these beautiful structures for string theory, in terms of the framework of Edward Frankel's question, have those mathematical physicists discovered something, or have they invented something?
I believe they invented it.
Okay. That totally makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard Sabina Hassenfelder. She really goes off on the string theory stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really follow her. She's great. Yeah.
So do you think it's valuable to invent something like that, or is it a waste of time and money?
Well, the answer, basically, the question is not even a modern one. It goes back centuries. So And it has to do with this distinction between research. Like you have basic research that is that has to do with pure sciences, and you also have applied research that has to do with engineering and the applied, let's say, sciences. So the answer that they have given in terms of philosophy of science, let's say, let's call it like that, is that it has value in terms of education. Like this is a way that you can construct, let's say, or you can come up with this type of structure or whatever. So, and they say that even if it has only value in terms of education and pedagogy, still it has value. So that's the main response there.
Well, you know how Ian McGilchrist is always talking about the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, and he feels like in our current age, the left hemisphere has become too dominant, and that the problem with the left hemisphere is that it has a tendency to go off on its own and start building sandcastles in the sky that are not useful. Is that part of what's happening here? Is this, you know, building structures that are very fascinating, and you can get, it's almost like the same kind of thing that happens with conspiracy theories. It's some sort of reciprocal narrowing. You can get into this reciprocal narrowing and lose contact with reality.
Yes, exactly. And I believe a good way to understand such things is follow the money. Like, they keep doing this, they, as Sabine often mentions, they keep reiterating, let's say, the same results again and again, making minute, let's say, incremental additions, because they will get more and more grants.
And, almost like Apple iPhone, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing, I think, also applies 100%, as you said, in the domain of technological innovation, with these very small incremental changes, and also with the conspiracies that you mentioned, because a conspiracy at the end of the day attracts views, and therefore it also gathers, let's say, it also has some monetization potential, let's call it like that.
Yeah. And it also has the benefit of making you not look at the actual conspiracies.
Yeah.
So, 100%. So let me play this little clip. You sent me a really interesting video that I would like to share just the first part of it with people, because I think it's pretty cool. Let's see. Can you see the quote on the screen from Peter Bernstein?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to go back sort of to the beginning here and take a look at this, just like 1 minute of this video here.
Now I want to get a little philosophical. One of my great heroes, Peter Bernstein, probably the best thinker in a philosophic sense, and a real investment sage who sadly passed away around 2009, once said, essentially, risk says we don't know what's going to happen. We walk every moment into the unknown. He said there's a range of outcomes, and we don't know where the actual outcome is going to fall within the range. And often we don't know what the range is. So in other words, we have ignorance to varying degrees about what the future holds. And it is from this.
Okay, I'm just going to put that quote up on the screen. We're going to talk about that for a second. Essentially, risk says we don't know what's going to happen. We walk every moment into the unknown. Well, he's talking about finance, but I mean, that's life, right? So do you have any comments on that, Harish? I think you're on mute.
Yeah, sorry. So basically, one of the, let me put it like that. One of the key attributes of being human, let's say, it's what we call pattern recognition. So humans, they are excellent at picking up different patterns, okay? Of course, one might make the case that with the recent advancement in transformer or large language models technology, now the machines, they are better than humans in recognizing these patterns, okay? And that's a completely different discussion that maybe we can have in another instance. What I wanted to notice here is the following. Human beings are great at picking up patterns. And another characteristic of our humanity, let's say, is that we human beings, we are prone to errors. Okay, humans err a lot. So these are the two of the defining characteristics of what it means to be a human. And what we are trying to achieve in life is to be able to reduce the error in our forecasting. So we are trying to do it in different ways, but one of them is that we are trying to decrease the amount of uncertainty in any situation or domain, let's say, we might find ourselves into. So the risk is that we are not, when we venture into into this unknown, as Peter Bernstein calls it, the risk there, it has to do with us not being able to correctly, let's say, forecast what is going to happen. But as I understand it, that's one of the key characteristics of what it means to be a human, because we always make errors. So it's only human to not be able to, let's say, don't know exactly what's going to happen in tomorrow. We can try to develop tools in order to help us forecast what is going to happen. But it is very difficult because we are embedded in complex dynamical systems. And it's not very easy to recognize the patterns, let's say. And because you also have this tendency of trying to recognize the patterns, in many instances, we pick up, let's say, the wrong ones. Or we pick up, let's say, only a small, we investigate into only a small subset of the whole set of the information that we have. And we have this, all these bias kicking in. And that leads us to not be able to predict and forecast what is going to happen. And this is what I think that it's the risk that he's referring to.
Well, so I think what you're talking about, it sounds to me like you're describing something like the, I think I've got this right, the idea of the active inference engine.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to decrease the surprisal, decrease the uncertainty.
Yeah.
Now, so the way I look at this is that I don't think that's what human beings are. I don't think that that I don't agree with the people that believe that we are active inference engines, because surprise is a very important part of our connection to reality and our connection to the transcendent. You know, Jordan Peterson always says that that when we err, we meet the transcendent. It's when we fail, when we come to the edge of our knowledge, that's where we meet the transcendent. Mm-hmm. So if we're actively working all the time to prevent surprise, to prevent discomfort, to prevent uncertainty, then we never come to that place where we have to lean into the unknown, where we have to receive the gift that's always being offered from the unknown into our lives. So, and I'm just going to throw this in here because you brought up the whole large language model thing. And one of the things Daniel McShay said in that video where I made that little clip of him talking about ecology, mm-hmm. but later on he was talking about the part to him that seems as though a large language model is certainly not yet at the place of AGI or of being anything like a human being, is that never, ever will a large language model ever respond to a request with, yeah, I don't know, I don't feel like it, not right now. So he said, yeah, there's something about motivation that is inimical to human beings and, well, to any living thing. Motivation is essential. And I mean, I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you, but that motivation, I think, drives all the way down to the beginning of the very first life. There has to be a will to survive. There has to be a motivation that even pushes forward the first action, because without a will to survive, there's not going to be any action.
No, I fully agree with you. Yeah. What I cannot is the following. Let's say the whole effort of scientists to develop these models in order to better predict, let's say, or make a better forecasts, including the work of Carl Friston and, let's say, the active inference framework, mm-hmm. they are deeply innate into this, how you said, this will to not to survive, but to better understand, let's say. So, and how to we can better navigate these complex spaces. So mm-hmm. there are many different models out there. Some of them, they are based on probabilities, like in the case of active inference, it's all about Bayesian probabilities and all of that. And there is another type of different, let's say, strand that doesn't fully take into account that particular framework of probabilities and Bayesian statistics and all of that. And they used to, in statistics, they used to call those the frequentists. So it's a different type of approach to statistics. And when you study it a bit, you realize that they are discussing about the exact same things, but they are fitting them together in different ways. So the outcome, and therefore also their predictions, they are completely different. And in one way, it has to do with what Carl Friston said You do not have a self model. You are the self model. And so when you try to do the whole surprisal minimization thing, in a way you are refining your self model, let's say that you have. So in a way that notion is not a bad one, especially from the cognitive perspective. And recently, yesterday, basically, I participated in John Vervaeke's first class on the symbolic world that has to do with with the ritual. And one of the things that he mentioned was actually that this position that we are not the, that we do not operate with a model, but we ourselves are the model, is gaining more and more ground, let's say, in terms of cognitive science. So there is something there. Maybe.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. And when John Vervaeke says that, and when Carl Friston says that, and that just explodes all these implications in my brain that if that's true of us, then they must be saying that that would also be true of lower organisms, lower entities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's drive it all the way down. If a cell is a model of its environment, okay, that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
If it has to be a model of its environment before it can go through the active inference process, then there's something before the cell that's giving the cell the model of its environment.
Yeah.
I don't see how that can be just something that you pick up before there is life. How on earth do you build a model?
And I think here is the main difference. We can understand it because we have our faith to support this. You understand? Maybe what they are currently trying to do is like to disconnect any leaps of faith, let's say, that they are associated with these questions, turn the whole teleology thing into teleonomy, as Michael Levin, and not only him, but basically all the evolutionary biologists are doing. They are opting for this and disconnect, let's say, from the real. But as we discussed a bit earlier on, they have to make that leap at some point. And maybe they are not willing, let's say, to make it in terms of it was God and the Lord, but the other venue, let's say, they have available, maybe it's the Platonic notion. So of this Platonic world of forms and the creator and all of that in that way. So yeah.
So for the people who aren't familiar, could you distinguish between teleology and teleonomy?
Yeah, basically teleology is the telos that an entity has, a living entity, let's say. It's the purpose, let's say, and what exactly is its aim, and let's say the goal. So for a human being, basically, the teleology one might say that is to procreate and to leave, let's say, offspring. And another way to look at it in this particular context might be to be a good ancestor. So, yeah. Now, back in the, if I am not mistaken, back in Basically, right after Darwin came up with the whole theory of evolution, there was a split between this usage of the theological terminology that has these religious connotations, and they opted instead for the use of the term teleonomy, that it doesn't have this, as they call it, baggage, let's say, within it. So now they are talking about what is the laws, because teleology has to do with the logos of the telos, of the aim, let's say, of the end. Teleonomy has to do with the telos and nomos. Nomos in Greek means rules. So they are trying to assess what are the rules that guide, let's say, that particular entity towards their goals. So this is the fine distinction there.
Okay, that's very helpful, I think. The other question I have for you in regards to Platonism, because I have not studied Plato. And when I hear someone like John Bervakey or Michael Levin talk about Platonism as an alternative to looking at a world that was created by a creator, I don't get it. Because if Platonism says these forms exist, these numbers exist, mathematics exists, independent of, so even if you change the laws of physics, mathematics would still be what it is, and numbers would still be what they are. And so Plato obviously didn't have a refined idea of God, but he must have thought this stuff came from somewhere.
Yeah. And he actually called, he was the first one, if I am not mistaken, that used the word the demiurge. And actually, in that particular passage from the Timaeus dialogue, he uses demiurge specifically. So it was the...
Well, isn't the demiurge just like a lesser god? I mean, isn't the demiurge still a god?
Yeah, I think that's a... In a way that we can understand that as a type of anachronism, because it is a different interpretation that came with the Neoplatonists way after Plato had written those dialogues. So some of them, someone maybe can even recognize the term demiurge as a lesser god, as you said, in the lore of the Gnostics, which is it is recognized as a heresy, at least in Eastern Orthodox Christianity. So I don't believe back in Plato, which we are talking about the 5th century in BC, he had that conception. In his cosmo conception, he was talking about the demiurge as the creator of the world soul. So I think there is a distinction there that came only 5-6 centuries late.
Well, okay, so let's take Plato's original concept then. The demiurge is the creator of the world soul.
Mm-hmm.
What did he mean when he said creator?
Okay.
I mean, the creator, in other words, there's some other world than this world, and that creator is outside of this world if it's creating the world soul of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that distinguished from...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we use the word God very loosely, I guess, but how is that distinguishable from the way we use God?
Allow me to just share
Oh, look
here.
at you. You've got it all ready for us.
Let me just share here.
I can see it. Yeah.
Yeah, great. Okay, I will quickly go through it. This is the passage for anyone that wants to read it. It is found from the Timaeus dialogue, lines 34c up to 36c. In this specific translation from the Greek word, the Greek text, the word demiurgos, the demiurge, it gets translated as God. So this is just also something that has to do with the translation from the original, let's say. But let's go with this one. Just allow me to read a little bit from the those lines in this passage. A very interesting passage, by the way. Now God did not make the soul after the body, although we are speaking of them in this order. For having brought them together, he will never have allowed that the elder should be ruled by the younger. But this is a random manner of speaking which we have, because somehow we ourselves too are very much under the dominion of chance. Whereas he made the soul in origin and excellence prior to an altar than the body, to be the ruler and mistress of whom the body was to be subject. And he made her out of the following elements and on this wise: out of the indivisible and unchangeable, and also out of that which is divisible and has to do with material bodies, he compounded a third and intermediate kind of essence, partaking of the nature of the same and of the other. And this compound he placed accordingly in a mean between the indivisible and the divisible and material. And then he goes on and on making this
let's stop
level
here.
Of extraction, let's say.
Yeah, let's stop here for a second, because this is basically talking about this whole idea of polarity and relationship. But it also sounds like it's very similar to the master and the emissary, or only in this case, in this one, the language is being used of mistress and emissary, which I think for me, and I'm not a neuroscientist or any of those things, but when I read McGilchrist's work, it sounds to me as though when he talks about the master and the emissary, he's actually talking about the feminine archetype and the masculine archetype.
I agree.
And so in that case, this word mistress actually works quite well. If you're looking at these as the two hemispheres of the brain, but obviously in this thing, he's talking about something above and outside of the human person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something before. But I mean, in all of these things, I think these are what, symbols or pictures or patterns that exist all the way through reality. So let me just read this part again for people who can't see the screen. So now that we've talked about it a bit, they'll put it together. Mm-hmm. Now, God did not make the soul after the body, although we are speaking of them in this order. For having brought them together, he would never have allowed that the elder should be ruled by the younger. That's very interesting. When you think about scripture and how many times the younger ends up ruling the elder, when there's two brothers, that's very interesting. So he would never have allowed that the elder should be ruled by the younger. But this is a random manner of speaking, which we have, because somehow we ourselves too are very much under the dominion of chance. Whereas he made the soul in origin and excellence prior to and older than the body to be the ruler and mistress of whom the body was to be the subject. And he made her out of the following elements and on this wise: out of the indivisible and unchangeable, and also out of that which is divisible and has to do with material bodies. So here we have the the non-physical and the physical. He compounded a third and intermediate kind of essence. Would that be John Vervaeke's transjective? Partaking of the nature of the same and of the other. And this compound he placed accordingly in a mean between the indivisible and the divisible and the material. So he has this polarity between the indivisible and the divisible, or what we would say in language, between the uncountable and the countable.
Yes.
And there is some relationship between these two things, and that relationship constitutes a third element. Did I get that right?
Perfectly.
Okay. And then he proceeds from there, it looks like, to do mathematical things with that idea, breaking it down into ratios and proportions.
Yeah. And actually, from that point onwards, it becomes somewhat cryptic, this passage, because a lot of scholars, they try to understand it. And some of them, they offered some different interpretations. Because I got into it, and I really believe that this is one of the origin texts that many of the thinkers that we have currently, they actually got inspired by it. And maybe in a way, this is a form of a hidden source. Some of them, they are not willing to recognize it as an influential source. But I do. I think that it influenced a lot of thinkers, not only today, but also from that point, let's say, over the centuries. And I had this hunch, let's say, that I could create I could take, let's say, my own theory and that meta-hypothesis that I had, and in a way create a specific instantiation of it that was gonna allow me to better understand, but also potentially decode this cryptic passage, let's say, from Plato.
Wow.
So I will just mention it briefly here before I go into the details. Basically, I believe that prime numbers, but also something that it is called primordials. Primordial is something that it is used in sieve theory. And it is a very basic notion that is the following. You know, prime numbers, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, so on. The notion of the primordial is the following. We take those prime numbers and we factor them together. So the first primordial, for example, will be the number 2. The second primordial will be the number 6. Because when we multiply the first prime number with the second, 2 times 3, we get 6. And the third one will be 210. The third one will be 30, because it's 2 times 3 times 5. The fourth one, accordingly, is going to be 210. 2 times 3 times 5 times 7, and so on.
Right,
so,
okay.
So my idea, and it was the following. Prime numbers and primordials can be utilized to decode Plato's cryptic passage from the Timaeus on the creation of the world soul. So that's the hypothesis I was going to test, I was planning to test. And if you want, I can show you what I came up with.
Sure, I would love to see that.
Great. So this is the passage, and basically, as I understand the passage, it includes specific instructions that we can understand them either as a set of instructions or as a recipe, let's say, or even as a as an algorithm. So it has to do with these numbers and these ratios. So
before you take this, would you go back to that one before you take that off the screen? I just want to say one thing about, you see where the letter X is there? It's up about eight lines from the bottom. Okay. The line that I'm looking at is this entire compound he divided lengthways into two parts, which he joined to one another at the center, like the letter X, and bent them into a circular form, connecting them with themselves and each other at the point opposite to their original meeting point. The picture that immediately came into my mind when I read that is the division of the cell and the way that the genes separate in the cell. That's an exact picture.
Okay.
That's very just putting a pin there. So now let's go on to the next thing.
That's very interesting. So another, before we move, and just another small point to highlight, he took the three elements of the same, the other, and the essence, and mingled them into one form. Okay, so we have three different let's say, in distinctions here. The same, the other, and the essence. Okay. So, okay. Here I have the procedure, let's say. And next to it, I also have, I have the actual line from that passage from Plato. So, basically, I'm making the following assumption. Let's assume that, as we said, this whole, according to the text, is comprised from three different elements. Okay, the same, the other, and the essence. Now, let's assume that all of those, they carry the equal weight. Okay, it is something that it is, in a way, hinted in the text, in the passage. Now, according to my hypothesis, is that primorials and prime numbers can be utilized to decode this specific set of instructions. So one of the things that I am assuming here, and I am starting from that specific point, is that I am assigning a specific weight to each of those three elements. And that's my starting point. So I am saying that the weight, let's call it like that, for each of those three elements, it's 168,000. That's the weight we are starting, okay? That's our starting point.
Now, is that a number that comes from the Timaeus or a number that you're theorizing?
That's a number that basically it comes from two different sources. One, it arises out of that initial hypothesis regarding the primordials. Okay, because in a way, the numbers I am using here, they are multiples of those primordials, specifically. Mm-hmm. The fifth primordial, that is 2 × 3 × 5 × 7 × 11, okay, and also the fourth one, that is 210, 2 × 3 × 5 × 7. So I am using multiples of that very basic, let's say, primordial, and the other source that comes is a different dialogue from Plato himself, specifically a dialogue called The Laws, which he actually references the number 5040 as a good candidate to describe the partitions within the ideal city. And the reason that he's choosing that number is because it is a, I'm going to use a technical term, a superabundant number. That it means that it has many divisors. So it is easy to, it is useful to use that number. Okay, so I took these two different set of clues, let's call it like that. One coming from my own research into primality, and the other from that other passage from Plato himself that is called the Laws. So should I go through the steps?
Yes. This is okay. Really interesting.
Great. So the first step, and I'm going to read it. First of all, he took away one part of the whole. So you see, we have the whole, and according to the passage, he starts like a sculptor, let's say, removing parts, right? So first of all, he took away one part of the whole. Now, what I am doing here is that I am working on the opposite way. So let's assume that we start from this whole that is 504,000. Okay. And in the first step, I am taking away one part of the whole, like I'm removing a part. Now, I believe that the measure that Plato is using is this number here, 10,500. And this number here is 5 times, it's 50 times the fourth primordial, 210.
Right.
So the only extra assumption I'm making here is that I am using these numbers that you see here, and I'm saying that the way to decode this passage is to, instead of taking into consideration that the first part that he took away from the whole, it is one, the only thing I am saying it is half. Okay, and this will make sense later, but I am using that specific, let's say, initialization into my construction or deconstruction. So I am taking this number and I am removing half of 10,500. Okay, let's proceed to the second step. Then he separated a second part, which was double the first. Okay, so double the first will be our measure. Our measure is 10,500. So we remove, once again, double the first from the whole. For this third step, it reads, then he took away a third part, which was half as much again as the second, and 3 times as much as the first. So actually, this step, I understand it as he took 1.5, 1.5 times the measure out. Because it is half as much again as the second, and 3 times as much as the first. For step number 4, then he took a fourth part, which was twice as much as the second. Once again, we take twice that particular measure that we are using here in our deconstruction. And a fifth part, which was 3 times the third. So the third here, as you can see, was 1.5 times the measure. And the fifth part is 3 times that one. So it's 4.5 times the measure. and it continues, and a sixth part, which was eight times the first. So the first, and now I think it becomes clear why I started with the half at the beginning. Eight times half is actually four. So this is why I'm taking that particular, let's say, amount out of it on this specific step. Moving forward, and a seventh part, which was 27 times the first, once again, 27 times half, it's 13.5. So we also reduce that particular amount. And after this, he filled up the intervals. And when you count the intervals, you realize that that actually is 21 times that specific measure. And then the whole instruction routine, it ends with the following. And thus, the whole mixture out of which he cut these portions was all exhausted by him. So once again, when we start with this sum, and we start step by step removing these parts according to the instructions, we're gonna have zero as a remainder, and therefore the whole was exhausted, let's say, in this fashion. So you can see here I'm having some extra squares here, some figures, and I will try to elaborate on them here. So you remember we said we started with three parts, three equal weighted parts, the same, the other, and the essence. One example to understand it is like, here is the partition that has to do with the primorials, basically, and also with the prime numbers. So let's focus on this side over here. This is an example of what each of these parts or columns in this specific arrangement look like. So we have a part that breaks down into four different individual parts, and each of which carries the very same weight. And when we zoom in into each specific smaller part, let's say within each of these three entities, we will find different pairs, and pairs of prime numbers specifically. And what I am offering here, it's just a specific example that I came up with. Like if somebody else tries, maybe they will come up with a different, they will discover a different specific arrangement of twin prime of prime pairs that fit together in each of these boxes. So,
do you have any idea how many potential pairs there would be that would create that number?
Yeah, I think we can calculate that actually based on combinatorics, because each line here, as you see, it has a specific sum, mm-hmm. that is 10,500. So if we, I am sure that I can calculate that, maybe with a combinatorics formula where I can make the calculation of the different possibilities and then remove the duplicates. So I will get to that number. So yeah, I don't have that number, but I think it can be calculated, yes.
Okay.
So going back to that particular line that you noticed with the letter X,
uh-huh.
the entire compound, he divided lengthwise into two parts, which he joined to one another at the center, like the letter X, and bend them into a singular form, connecting them with themselves and each other at the point opposite to the original meeting point. Okay. So as I understand this, I imagine these three circles, let's say, that each of them he created this X. We can see it here as a cross. It's the same. And basically, I imagine it as a type of weights where you have a disc, and each disc carries the same weight. But if somehow you went and you cut it into four parts, and then you weighted each of them differently, you will also realize that they carry the exact same weight, each of them. So this is my particular, let's say, attempt at decoding this specific passage from the Timaeus.
Well, one of the things that pops into my mind when I'm looking at this picture is this like holographic principle that all of the information that is in a sphere can be represented on the exterior of the sphere. I don't know why that popped into my head, and I have no idea
Oh,
if it means
it's a
anything,
good,
but
yeah, it's a good intuition, and I think it has to do with this projection from the 2D to the 3D, that it is appropriate. And it also it makes sense. Like this is just a 2D, let's say, representation, but if we try to actually transform it, then we will have something of a hologram, let's say, like these circles or discs stacking up to each other, and each of them having these characteristics, let's say.
One of the other reasons this is super interesting to me is that you and I have talked before about this, and we've been talking on the channel for a long time about this whole idea of chiastic structures, structures that are represented by an X, for many reasons. But when you're talking about using it as a representation of a different kind of narrative, it usually means starting from a place of abundance and then squeezing down through a narrow point and then moving back out to a place of abundance. But in cognitive science, they've been talking recently about this idea of a bow tie structure, and that's exactly what they mean. They mean this X structure. And Michael Levin has found a way to take that idea and use it when he's talking about cell communication and cognitive light cones and all that stuff. He's talking about this bow tie structure. So this is very interesting in terms of that if what we think is that this bow tie structure or this chiastic structure is fundamental to the universe, and it shows up everywhere. It shows up all through the scriptures, and it shows up in our lives, and it shows up in every narrative, and it shows up in cognitive neuroscience, and shows up in biology, probably shows up in physics and everywhere else. So that's very interesting that Plato saw something of this 5,000 years ago, or however long ago, no, 27, 2600 years ago, something like that.
Something like that,
Yeah, fascinating. Well, obviously, we have to do this again. We can't just stop here. Did you want to kind of wrap this up a little bit, and then maybe we could have another conversation in the future?
Yes. So what I just wanted to say is the following, like I find it in that particular example. I find many things fascinating. One of them is that in a way, we presented, let's say, here to the audience, one of the fundamental texts, at least in terms of Western thought, and no, in a novel way. And we also try to take this notion of the meta hypothesis and how we can actually instantiate it in order to toggle that specific, let's say, task that in this case was to understand that particular passage on the creation of the word soul from Plato. So I am using that specific meta hypothesis to generate, at least so far, two more up to this point hypotheses that also have to do with the things that I know, uh-huh. that prime numbers and philosophy of mathematics and all of that. And it works, at least for me, as a very good framework in order to tackle and address difficult problems. So this is what I wanted to share with you and everyone else. And yeah, once again, I just wanted to say thank you, Karen, for giving me this opportunity to share these ideas with you.
Well, this has been fascinating. I had one question about your framework. I noticed mm-hmm. that you're using one half and then one and then one and a half as you're going through the parts. Because you were using the number 5250 as 50 times the primoria of 210. But was there a reason you didn't use 25 times the primoria and then just use whole numbers? Like then your whole numbers would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, 8, 27, 42.
Yeah.
Was there a reason you didn't do it that way?
The reason is that basically I had arrived, as I told you, to that particular potential solution from two different sources. One was from Plato, from the Laws, referencing this number 5040, and the other was from some other results in terms of primality that me myself had discovered, and both of them they in a way they guided me to start from there.
So the number 50 is important then.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's important. And I am not sure how far we can stretch this importance, let's say, there. I don't want to enter into strange realms like numerology and all of that. I am not into that. But I believe that there is something extremely useful in the number five, in terms that it is exactly half of the decad of the 10. So mm-hmm. there is something at play there that has to do with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's just easier for me to think in terms of whole numbers, but that's because mm-hmm. I'm not a mathematician. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Harish, for sharing your time with us today and sharing your thoughts. And I have learned so much and I look forward to our future conversation. And hopefully we can tie this in more into the video on risk, because there were a lot of things in there. You said it's only 4 minutes long, but it really tells you everything you need to know. So
yeah. We can cover that in a different in another discussion. Last thing before we close, I just wanted to say thank you to two people. One of them is three people. One of them is Johannes Niederhauser from Halcyon Academy. He's the one that he taught me a course on Plato, and I actually presented that particular solution to his channel a while back. The other is Thomas Njogin. He's another professor that I recently had another course with him on the, again, on Plato and on the notions of beauty. And that was also very helpful. And actually, it was Thomas that introduced me to that specific channel on finance. And he shared with me not that specific video, but I picked up the channel and I found that one. So, yeah. And also a last shout out to my good friend Chance Mills from the corner. I know I've mentioned it to him to you in the past in some email transactions, but he was really helpful because he helped me dive deep into this notion of consilience that was really helpful to me.
Yeah, and in reference to this I using finance as a frame, I have an episode coming up very soon between two economist types that are talking about biology. So there's very interesting crossover happening there. So
Okay, awesome.
Cool. Well, we'll talk soon.
Thank you so
Thank you,
much.
Harris. Have a great day. Or
You
for you,
too.
it's evening.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.